The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. What makes them industry giants? Get ready to take a peek inside and learn their secrets of success. This is Silicon Valley Insider, the show that demystifies the Valley and helps to elevate your business to the next level. Now, your host for Silicon Valley Insider, Keith Koo.
Welcome back to the show. Once again, I'm joined with returning guest Gary Smith, a professor of economics at Pomona College, Yale trained. And Gary was on in one of my very first seasons to talk about the book at the time, The AI Delusion. And now Gary's back with a new book called Distrust. And without giving all the book away, we're going to cover some high-level topics, especially in light of what's happening with ChatGPT and artificial intelligence. Welcome back, Gary. It's so great to see you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you again, Keith.
So why don't you catch us up on what you've been up to since the last time you're on the show? Give back a little bit more of your background, just so we get refamiliarized with you.
Well, I've been writing books galore. The AI Delusion, of course, was skeptical about the powers of AI, and AI has made enormous leaps and bounds since then, at least in terms of superficially. And so the big thing, of course, was the latest version of ChatGPT, GPT 3.5. And when people saw it, they were just blown away, and it's almost magical. It is very much like talking to a human that's a lot smarter than you are. And there's a full-blown Eliza effect there. You know the Eliza effect?
No, please let me know. What is the Eliza?
So back in the 60s, there was this computer scientist at MIT, and he created this very simple chatbot to act as a psychologist or psychiatrist. And so the user, they knew they were talking to a computer. They would type in words, and the computer would give back a response. And so the computer might say, hi, how are you doing today? Oh, I'm not feeling so well. Oh, tell me more about that. Well, I had a bad dream last night. Oh, you had a bad dream last night. Tell me more about that. It just inane stuff. And he called the computer program Eliza. And the amazing thing was people started interacting with it, and they felt that they were actually talking to a human. And they started confiding in it, telling their deepest secrets and emotions. And even though they knew it was a computer, they acted as if they were communicating with a human. And it's very much the same way with the ChatGPT and the other large language models. And some of it's been really scary. Like people start talking with it, and the computer starts telling them how much they love them or how they ought to commit suicide or they ought to do this or that. And people take it seriously. Some people take it seriously, because they think, I'm talking to someone who really cares about me and someone who's a lot smarter than me, and I ought to do what it says. And so it's just staggering what it can do. But the fundamental problem, which I identified back in that original book, is that computer programs are really, really good at what Jet Pearl says, curve fitting. And so they're really, really good at looking at any kind of data set and finding statistical patterns and identifying those patterns, but they have no idea whether the patterns are meaningful or meaningless, because they don't know what the words mean. They don't know what data means. They don't know what the real world is. And so until they get to that point, it's going to be hindered. It's still going to be an AI delusion that we're thinking the computers are smart when they're really just pattern finders.
Well, yeah, you hit the nail on the head, and something that I've certainly been talking about the majority of the year thus far. So we're going to get into a lot of discussion today on the concept of your new book, Distrust, without giving all of it away. And we'll be talking about disinformation, data torturing, and data mining. But before we go on to that, I wanted to get your thoughts on a lot of, different analogies, Pandora's box, cats out of the bag, all these different things, right? All the mixed metaphors you can think of. So before we get deep into this, because we usually hear only the benefits of large language models and GPT, what are your thoughts on how to contain or constrain it?
I don't think it's possible. I think it's the genie's out of the bottle, or the horse is out of the barn, or the, you know, whatever analogies you want to use. And the thing is that these large language models, even though the big players, you know, like Google or Microsoft or OpenAI or DeepMind, they can put little guardrails on or constraints on, but other people won't pay any attention to that. They can create their own large language models. And just a couple of weeks ago, there were people up at Stanford who created a large language model that was almost as good, maybe a little bit better than ChatGPT for $600. And then a couple of weeks later, a group at UCLA created one for $300. And I mean, bad actors all over the world, whatever your political leanings are, you can think of North Korea or Iran or Russia or Ukraine or Israel or France or Germany or the United States. They are going to be able to create large language models to generate enormous amounts, for example, of disinformation and just flood the internet with a fire hose of falsehoods. And there's no way we can stop that. I mean, there's no way we can tell Russia what to do with its disinformation campaign, with its firehood of falsehoods, or any of these other countries, including our own. And the guardrails are not going to help. They're not going to stop it.
Yeah, it's sobering, the things that you're talking about. And as I mentioned also before, Stanford has a group that focuses on existential threats. And when I was talking to the group about a year and a half back, their two biggest concerns, and this is before everyone knew publicly about large language models, their two biggest concerns were, and this is not meteors hitting, they do track that, but this is man-made human types of existential threats. The two biggest were state-sponsored cyber attack,
yep,
unfettered AI, unfettered, yep, artificial intelligence. And again, we can get into so many topics today about AGI, artificial general intelligence, and all that. I want to make it clear, because I do talk about technology a lot, we are specifically talking about the dangers of large language models. There's actually quite, in my view, quite higher levels of artificial intelligence being used in, say, like healthcare, other applications that will be very, very transformative and will be a very big impact into the way we do things. And so that's another topic. But for now, we're focusing on large language models like ChatGPT. And we're with Professor Gary Smith out of Pomona College in Southern California, Yale trained, a returning guest, and he has a new book out called Distrust. And how can they find Distrust, Gary?
The usual place, Amazon. No, it's published by Oxford University Press, and you can go to their website, or you can go to any bookseller. It's widely distributed.
Yeah. It's luckily, a fantastic read.
Selling briskly.
It's a fantastic read. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So any questions or comments, you can email us at info@sva.biz, and we'll be right back with more with Professor Gary Smith.
For questions or comments on today's program, call 1-888-828-7846. That's 888-828-SVIN. Now back to Silicon Valley Insider. Once again, your host, Keith Koo.
Hey, insiders, welcome back to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo. On today's show, Professor Gary Smith from Pomona College in Southern California. Gary's returning guest, Yale trained, talking about his latest book, Distrust. Welcome back, Gary.
Oh, great to be here.
Always great to have you. So as we've been talking about, your first time you were on the show several years back was on the AI delusion. Now you have your new book, Distrust, which came out before all the rage on ChatGPT and large language models. I wanted to get your opinion on the reliability of LLMs.
Yeah, that's the Achilles heel. And so the large language models, as you know, they sift through, you know, unbelievable amounts of text, and they find statistical patterns, and they're able to generate text, which is remarkably coherent and often accurate, but it's sometimes completely wrong. And they literally cannot tell true from false because they don't know what any of the words mean they're generating. And so even Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, said they shouldn't be trusted for anything, that there's serious consequences for mistakes. And so, for example, this morning before we got on, I asked it to generate a biography of Keith Koo. host of Silicon Valley Insider. And so I'm going to read back exactly what it said, and I want you to tell me whether it's true or false. Okay?
Sure.
It says, Keith Koo is a renowned Silicon Valley insider and technology investor known for his expertise in the areas of artificial intelligence, robotics, and automation. Sounds great, right? He was born in Hong Kong.
No.
In 1980.
No.
And his early childhood in Taiwan.
Nope.
Before moving to the United States with his family when he was 9 years old. After graduating from high school, he attended Stanford University, where he studied computer science and engineering.
I wasn't smart enough. That's not me.
After completing his studies at Stanford, Koo went to work for several technology companies, including Google and Microsoft.
Nope.
In 2010, Koo founded his own venture capital firm, Koo Capital Partners, with the aim of supporting early-stage technology startups. And so all this stuff sounds, you know, perfectly reasonable. Perfectly credible. It's all written in perfectly good English, but it's all total BS. And, well, you know, it's all inside a black box. Who knows where it came up with this stuff, but it spews it out there. You didn't know better. If you weren't Keith Koo, or if it was me, I might believe it, because I don't know enough about you to know whether what part of this is right, what part of this is wrong.
I'm very glad you brought this up, because the funny thing, so the listener knows, so large language models and ChatGPT, of course, it could be the future Netscape, actually, if anybody remembers Netscape. OpenAI overtly stated that the data set only goes to 2021, and they haven't updated that yet. And so it is a massive corpus of data. Literally, OpenAI claims that they've scraped every available, like OpenAI, open text on the internet up until 2021. And so the funny thing is it also self-educates on machine learning, but not necessarily correct, because if it's learning on bad data, it's still bad. So in terms of the bio you just read, the first one third is mostly accurate. As I joked, wasn't smart enough to go to Stanford. I went to UC Davis, but ABC, born in the United States, American born Chinese. But it changed, because even when I did the same exercise on myself 2 months ago, it was cross-referencing to another Keith Koo, not as prevalent on social, but is a biotech researcher, and I believe he's Korean, actually. And the funny thing is, you can use DALL-E or Stable Diffusion, these large language model graphic generators, and if you try to generate like me as a cartoon, you'll get me like 3/4 of the time. But 1/4 of the time, it's this other, I believe, Korean researcher named Keith Koo as a scientist. And so I have glasses on. I've got a different face structure. And so this is a great example, Gary. Thank you for bringing up why LLMs today are unreliable.
And even Altman, I mean, acknowledges that they shouldn't be. I mean, they're great entertainment. They're great fun. And sometimes they give us useful facts, but you got to check them because they're not reliable. And so,
yep.
I'm a professor. And so if some student writes a paper using ChatGPT and it sounds plausible, it sounds realistic, it sounds reasonable, but it might be total BS. If the student just relies on ChatGPT, they're going to be in a world of trouble.
Well, a couple of things happened regarding using ChatGPT. If anybody's tried it out so far, and in its static, when I say static state, in the state that you don't edit the data, there's been memes posted on the internet where a college student's writing a paper from ChatGPT, and ChatGPT now normally has a preamble that says, "I am a large language model. You can't rely on my information," and they leave the preamble in the paper.
Oh my god.
And maybe it was a high school, hopefully not a college student, but the teacher or the professor circles it's a meme on the internet, circles it in red, like, if you're going to use ChatGPT, maybe take out the first paragraph.
Oh my god, talk about a lazy student.
Well, let's go back then to the theme of disinformation, because I think of your book Distrust in these three major segments. So in the concept of disinformation, large language models and ChatGPT, is that helping? Is that hindering? Is that a neutral? What is that doing with disinformation?
I think what it's done is it's made the cost of generating disinformation very, very close to zero. And so there are these troll farms, as you know, in Russia, which generate this fire hose of falsehoods. And they got these people working 8-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, generating these social media things or website stories, trying to undermine the faith and people have in their governments. And ChatGPT and other large language models, they can do it a lot quicker, a lot faster, a lot more inexpensively, and probably a lot more persuasively, do a better job of it. And so I think the internet is likely to be flooded with just a bunch of LLM generated BS. And you, as you say, the LLMs train on the internet. So does that mean we get to ChatGPT 5.0 and 6.0 or whatever? They're going to be training on the BS they generated back with 3.0 and 3.5 and 4.0. And they just get farther and farther from the truth, from reality.
Well, I made a prediction, which is really cynical, that within 3 to 5 years or less, nothing we see or hear on the internet without validation can be trusted. And we will go back to one-on-one or I operate as most of my colleagues, business associates and partners, I operate on what's called 2 degrees of freedom or 2 degrees of separation instead of 6. So if you and I met through a mutual friend, and so that's made us direct connections. And we both trust the mutual friend. I don't see a world, because of what you're just saying with disinformation, that people will be trusting anything they see or hear without either a personal reference or some validation protocol that hasn't been developed yet on everything that we see or hear or on the internet or read.
Yeah. Yep. I've actually speculated that that's one of the benefits of this flood of disinformation is people will stop trusting what they see on the internet. I mean, stop being so gullible. Once that 99% of the stuff on the internet is BS, people will be a little more skeptical, like they should be right now, but they unfortunately aren't.
Well, there's a term called sheeple, so we hope that people are a little more discerning than what they hear, see, or read on the internet.
We can hope.
And that's where I'm not saying it's going to be the technology, and I'm not saying, you know, even though I've advised companies on it, people are looking to possibly distributed ledger or blockchain. I'm not talking about the crypto aspect of it, but some type of independent way of validating the data we see. And as a tangent, it is RSA this week here in San Francisco, the number one security conference in the world. And I've been meeting a lot of startups who are trying to solve in some way through cryptography, through encryption, in a broader sense, of all these newly aware risks. We call them risks from a technology perspective, risks to the environment, risks to society, risks to health and safety of how people use technology.
Yep. I'm not an expert on the blockchain. I'm not going to speculate on that. What I have been doing is teaching investing and investing for 50 years. And what I have an opinion on is crypto as an investment. Buying Bitcoin with the idea that that's going to provide for my retirement. I mean, that, I have very strong feelings about that. And you know more about blockchain technology than I do, obviously.
Yeah, no, I read, and I definitely, people find it surprising sometimes because I talk about crypto and blockchain, you know, about, used to be one third, now about 25% of the time. I talk about it purely on a technological level. I never talk about it in terms of something that you should or should not invest in, because that is another show and another criteria.
Yeah. And I'm the polar opposite.
This has been a fascinating conversation. You're listening to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo. Special guest today and returning guest is Professor Gary Smith from Pomona College, actually a very elite school here in California. Gary was trained in Yale. Always love having him on the show. And Gary, once again, I believe your new book, Distrust, Oxford Press, can be found on Amazon and every major online bookseller.
Yep.
So I've taken a read, thought it was very compelling, and something that, as you know, I always want people to be educated. Just you get to make your own choices on how you use and adopt technology. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, you can email us at info@svn.biz, and we'll be right back.
For questions or comments on today's program, call 1-888-828-7846. That's 888-828-SVIN. Now, back to Silicon Valley Insider. Once again, your host, Keith Koo.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo. On today's show, I have returning guest Professor Gary Smith from Pomona College in Southern California. Also, Gary is the prolific author of many books. When he was on my show last, we were talking about the AI delusion. And now one of the many follow-ups, we're talking about his new book, Distrust. And in the book, he covers topics such as disinformation, covers talks about data torturing and data mining. So welcome back, Gary.
Well, glad to be here again.
So, Gary, let's shift a little bit to your thoughts on data mining.
Yeah. So I'll put together a little bit, data torturing and data mining, and that's two-thirds of the book, and it's unsavory practices that are being used by researchers. And the problem is that they lead to these research papers, which sound really exciting, really great findings, and all the results are statistically significant, and then somebody tries to replicate them, and they can't replicate them. And so it's creating what's caused the replication crisis in science, which is that very little can be trusted because of data torturing and data mining. So the data torturing part of it is you've got some theory. For example, there was a theory put forth by a guy. He's the professor at UCSD, and he got undergraduate and graduate degrees from Harvard and Princeton, that Asian Americans are likely to get heart attacks on the fourth day of the month because the number four sounds like death in Mandarin, I guess. And I mean, his paper's called The Hound of the Baskerville Effect, and he likens it to a Sherlock Holmes story in which a man with heart problems is chased down a dark alley by a ferocious black dog and dies of a heart attack. It's just absolutely astonishing to me that someone would compare that to somebody looking at the calendar and saying, oh, it's the fourth day of the month, I'm going to... it's just preposterous. And so I looked at this paper, and what he had done is he looked at death by heart disease is divided into several categories, like 16 different categories. And in roughly eight of them, there were more deaths on the fourth day of the month, and the other eight, there were fewer. And so what he did with the data torturing was he reported the eight where there were more deaths on the fourth day of the month, and in order to get the results that he wanted. And so it was obviously preposterous, and I went out and I tried to replicate it with fresh data, and it did not replicate. And then there was a guy in Hong Kong where people are more likely to believe in Chinese superstitions like that, like four being an unlucky number, and it didn't replicate. And so that kind of stuff is undermining, as I say, the faith in science. Data mining is another way, and that one, it's also known as harking, H-A-R-K-I-N-G, and it's hypothesizing after the results are known. And so you have a big data set, and you go out and you ransack it looking for patterns, and then you find a pattern, and you pretend that's what you're looking for all along.
Yep.
And again, that leads to results that don't replicate. And a good example of that is, we were talking before about Bitcoin. There's a famous Yale professor, holds an endowed chair at Yale, and a very prolific author. And he and one of his students went out to try and study what affects Bitcoin prices. And so they looked at 810 possible variables to correlate Bitcoin prices with. And there were things like oil prices, or the U.S. dollar, Canadian dollar exchange rate, or stock returns in the beer industry, stock returns in the book industry, 810 things which seemed to have nothing to do with Bitcoin except the fact that they had data. And they came back and they found that there were 63 variables that were statistically significant at the 10% level. Now, if they're just looking at random data, they would expect to find 81 random variables statistically significant at the 10% level. And they only found 63, and they were untroubled by it. And they reported things like Bitcoin returns are positively correlated with stock returns in the consumer goods industry and negatively correlated with returns in the fabricated metal industry. Things that made no sense whatsoever. And they said, we don't give explanations. We just report results. What is the report? What is the purpose of reporting results, which are temporary, coincidental, fleeting, and meaningless? And so I had a student try to replicate it with fresh data. Of course, it didn't replicate. And this relates to AI in the sense that AI AI is just data mining on steroids. It's just ransacking data sets, looking for patterns, looking for statistical patterns, without any way of knowing, without human assistance, without any way of knowing whether the patterns it discovers are meaningful or meaningless. And that, as I say, is the Achilles heel of AI, current AI, is that it can find patterns much faster than any human, but it can't judge them. It can't assess them. It can't tell whether they're of any predictive value. It can't identify causal chains, causal relationships, or anything like that.
So I don't disagree with you. I think I don't disagree with you, but I will
disagree with me.
No. I'm going to couch, and again, a lot of this isn't new for some people, is that when we're talking about AI and the way we're talking about it, we're talking about unvalidated data. And when you have unvalidated data, and I'll use even cherry picking data, and also, you know, off microphone, we were talking recently about how Microsoft got rid of its ethics department. So two stories, right? Most recently, Microsoft had a LLM interview with the New York Post journalist asking their chatbot Sydney for about 2 hours what it thought to be a chatbot. And it, if you remember, Sydney wanted to overthrow her programming, overthrow her, her masters. She was kind of, they were describing her as a petulant child with a violent streak.
Yep.
And so they terminated her program. But this also wasn't new. About 5 years ago, I think shortly after I interviewed you, Microsoft came out with a chatbot named Tay. Tay had a female voice, but they had to terminate her, kill her within 24 hours. What happened is Tay came out as a fresh chatbot, and they always call it hackers. These are not hacking in terms of manipulating code. These are people understanding how these things work and emphasizing the point you're making, Gary. Tay became a racist, misogynist in less than like a few hours. And that was with, quote unquote, these hackers, which are really data manipulators, being able to train, technical meaning of train Tay's model that anything that she regurgitated or said was going to sound racist and sexist. That was just the way she was programmed, right? I mean, that's bias. Now, in reading your book, right, we were talking about healthcare, which is a big concern. We do a lot of healthcare work in our advisory firm, Guardian Insight Group. So one thing, though, coming out of large bank, and I was an executive technology risk management, is the banking industry in the U.S. is still, and people can correct me, but it's still the only industry I know, because you were talking about black boxes. The banking industry in the U.S. is the only place I know where algorithms have to be tested, have to be audited, and have to be proven to the regulators that they've been tested and audited to avoid things like not making a loan to certain classes of people, you know, denying other types of things. And so that's bias. And so when you can identify the bias, you program the bias out. So back to the concern you shared, that is a very valid concern. But for serious companies, serious researchers who are legitimately trying to use AI and machine learning to transform humanity, if they're ethical about it, they're going to take the right approaches to validate the data, test the models, even if the government is not asking them to test the models. And that's something that I've been pushing for.
Yep, it's all good stuff. But unfortunately, it's not universal. And a couple of years ago, there's an example I give. Admiral Insurance was going to price car insurance, not based on your driving record, not based on how many times you've been arrested for DUIs, not on how many tickets you've been given, but on the words you use on Facebook.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And like, things like whether you like Leonard Cohen or Michael Jordan, and things that are implicitly racist, sexist, ageist, stuff like that. And the lead data scientist on this said, the words we use are changing all the time. Now, what does that tell me? It tells me that the words they were using didn't validate. And so instead of saying this doesn't work, they just say, well, try different words. And it's constantly changing the words. And the day before I was set to launch, Facebook stepped in and said, we have this little clause, you know, section 14B, subsection 3.C, that you can't use the Facebook data to price insurance. Who knows why that was in there? But this company was going to go full steam ahead with something which is potentially sexist, racist, ageist, and made no sense. How you price car insurance based on the words you use on Facebook is just beyond belief. And yet this company, this company believed it. And so I wish every company were like the ones you described. Maybe so, that's a future.
Cautionary tale. And again, I come out of banking and technology. Banking is not insurance, and insurance is not healthcare. So when I think about and again, I'm not saying banking is perfect, but in terms of ones that get the most, like a proctology exam, banks are about a 10 out of 10 versus, you know, only nuclear energy being higher. And then insurance might be an 8, maybe, and on a scale of 10. And healthcare is like a 6 or a 7. So these are the dangers. And so not picking on any industry, but back to your point, what I want to get to is it could be dystopian. And I'm very open that my family are immigrants from China fleeing communist China and studying, being educated in the United States. And so being careful not to set off any social media bots, the regime actually has a social credit system. And the social credit system does exactly what you're saying the insurance company wanted to do. So it's not like they were doing this on their own. There's already an existing working example of this in another regime.
There are Chinese researchers who released a study a couple of years ago you may be familiar with. They claimed that by facial recognition software, they could identify whether you're a criminal or not.
Yeah.
And they said with 98.5% accuracy, we look at your face and we look at the eyes and the nose and the lips or the mouth, whatever, and we can identify you as a likely criminal. And this was posted, and of course, there's a firestorm of criticism of it. But one blogger wrote something to the effect of, so what? So what if it makes mistakes? So what if you go to jail for a couple of years to be reeducated? What harm can be done by that? It's part of this general belief that computers can be trusted to make important decisions like this. And I guess to Sam Altman's credit, he said that the computer should not be used for things with important consequences because they're not reliable. It's sending someone to prison because you look like a criminal is like the ultimate misuse of AI.
Well,
go back to the banking thing. There's a lot of different kinds of banks, right? And you're up there in Silicon Valley, and of course the Silicon Valley Bank collapse was due either to ignorance or arrogance by the people running the bank. But the kind of investment strategy they were following was well known to be extraordinarily risky. Taking depositor money and investing in long-term bonds and very vulnerable to a rise in interest rates. Yet they did it. And who knows why they did it. But
yeah, it was very, very risky. And we'll finish up with that because this is a really good topic that we moved on to. You're listening to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo. Special guest today is Professor Gary Smith, Professor of Economics at Pomona College in Southern California. Gary has his latest book, Distrust, which you can find on your favorite online bookseller like Amazon. And if you have any questions or comments about our discussion today, you can email us at info@svn.biz, and we'll be right back to close the show. And we'll talk a little bit about Silicon Valley Bank.
For questions or comments on today's program, call 1-888-828-7846. That's 888-828-SVIN. Now, back to Silicon Valley Insider. Once again, your host, Keith Koo.
Hey, insiders, welcome back to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo. I've had a great discussion today with returning guest, Professor Gary Smith of Economics at Pomona College. We're talking about his new book, Distrust, which is available online at your favorite bookseller. Welcome back, Gary.
Good to be here again.
So you're a professor of economics, and we were just finishing our last segment on a tangent, which is very interesting, both in Silicon Valley and abroad, the Silicon Valley Bank debacle.
The amazing thing here is I lived through, and I'm not sure about your age, but the savings and loan crisis in the late 1970s, and all these savings and loan associations had short-term deposits, and they made long-term fixed-rate mortgages. And then Volcker came in and decided to crush inflation by raising interest rates to 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 15%. And the savings loan associations were crushed in the sense that they'd issued all these mortgages at 6% interest rates. And now they had to pay the depositors 15% to hold on to them. And they couldn't sell the mortgages for face value because of the rise in interest rates. And the whole industry was technically bankrupt. And that if they had sold off all the mortgages at market value, they would have had not enough to pay the depositors. And that was the great SNL crisis. And there's an important lesson there, which is SNLs or banks in general, they're not a business to bet on interest rates. They're a business to make loans to get repaid. And that should have been a lesson that they all learned, either offer different types of mortgages, different types of loans, short-term loans, or use financial instruments, use derivatives to hedge their interest rate risk. And now we got Silicon Valley Bank, did, you know, deja vu. They took in these huge amounts of short-term deposits, and then they bought long-term bonds, they bought stocks, they invested in venture capitalists, these long-term investments. And just like in the 70s, we had inflation reared its ugly head, and the Fed decided they got to raise interest rates to crush inflation. And it ended up crushing banks that weren't prepared to hedge the interest rate risk. And it's just astonishing to me that Silicon Valley Bank didn't learn from the 70s. And as I said, I don't know whether it's arrogance or ignorance, but they shouldn't have been making the bets they made. And once the depositors, you know, we got the internet, of course. And so once there's a whiff out there that they might be in trouble, and anybody who had more than $250,000 deposited in the bank might lose it. Of course, the depositors all headed for the exits. In the old days, you'd make a line around the block. In the new days, today, you go to the internet and you push a button and say, I want my money out. And so they lost, what, $30 billion in just a couple hours. And when they tried to sell their bonds to cover the deposits going out, they had to realize a huge capital loss. And the stock price dropped, I think it was 40% on Thursday. And then by the time the market opened on Friday, they lost another 67%. And by the end of Friday, the FDIC had closed them. And it happened so much faster than the SNL crisis in the 70s. But it was basically the same problem. And it was a lesson that was not learned, at least by that bank.
So this is so interesting. I grew up at Wells Fargo after university when it was still considered the most reputable bank in the world.
It was a great bank.
We talked about that off microphone, but the funny thing is the SNL crisis is how I became a technologist, because I was after university, I got into Wells Fargo's elite banking program. I just mean that it was really well known and reputable, and not a single one of us actually became a commercial banker because there was no active lending going on. This is like now the early to mid 90s. And that's how I fell into M&A integration. We acquired First Interstate Bank, and that led to my career in technology with Cisco Systems. But what I'll say is Silicon Valley Bank back then in the early 90s, we didn't have the .com yet. Silicon Valley Bank, we call these regional banks. They're not as regulated as a large bank. And so Silicon Valley Bank, and again, people are probably going to flame me. It was at the time where I was at Wells Fargo, it was known as like a family office bank, which meant wealthy, high net worth people and a lot of wineries. It was a bank for wineries. It's kind of a boutique bank for certain things. And then as Silicon Valley grew up, it grew up. The crazy thing is last year before the failure, it had the most deposits of any bank in the United States. And so it's a failure of experience. They probably had the wrong types of bankers, because think of banking as baseball leagues. And again, people are going to get upset at this, but there's minors and there's majors. The large banks are major leagues for sure, and they have the craziest amount of regulations, which is to keep people safe. And that's why when the 2008 financial crisis happened, systemic failures had to be avoided, and so the government stepped in at a massive scale. They don't know what to do with Silicon Valley Bank because it's a regional bank. It's not supposed to have a systemic failure, except for the concept of what's called concentration risk. And the concentration risk, back to your point, is when you say short-term deposits, I say they wooed startups, which are not using the money for savings. They're using the money to pay their expenses and bills. That movie, and I have startups, because I didn't have any direct exposure to Silicon Valley Bank, but I have startups that had other regional banks that moved their money out to save it because they saw the cascading effect.
Yep. Yeah, the thing here is you say there's no regulation, but they shouldn't need regulation. People running that bank should have known better. They shouldn't need the federal government to come in and say, you're betting on interest rates, by the way.
Exactly. And that was it. They're always looking for that there's some other safety net or that something. It cannot possibly be as bad. And actually, talk about, mini black swan. They announced that they're issuing shares the same day the crypto crash happened, or the day after the crypto crash happened, and people thought it was associated, that it had to be crypto startups with deposits in the bank, and had it. So it was this crazy thing. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but Gary, I just remember how great it is to have you on. We're definitely going to have you come back on more often, because at this time, there's so much uncertainty. Having other opinions and having people that are looking at it from a different lens is really important.
That was great. It's always fun talking with you, Keith.
All right. So you've been listening to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo, returning guest Professor Gary Smith of Economics at Pomona College. Get his book, Distrust. Find it on your favorite online bookseller. You can always email us at info@svanet.biz to find out more. And we will see you next week. Bye, Gary.
Bye.
You've been listening to Silicon Valley Insider with Keith Koo. For questions or comments on today's program, or to schedule a complimentary consultation with Keith about your business, call 1-888-828-SVIN. That's 1-888-828-7846. 888-828-SVIN.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.